Hey guys, Joshua here, scientist and spiritual philosopher, and this is my actual voice. So I wanted to share something important before we begin this episode. Due to some considerations for the average listener of this podcast, I decided to split it up into two different sections. Section 1 and then the appendix. So as a result, the episode will be a little longer than normal than previous episodes. Section 1 will contain all of the primary arguments that I make in this episode in an easy-to-digest highlights reel that any layman can absorb. The appendix will have to do with my epistemological rationales, the mathematical calculations that underlie my arguments, and will primarily be of interest to the scientifically inclined or the scientifically curious. So what this means is you can listen to only section 1 and still ascertain all of my main arguments. If you want to skip the appendix after listening to section 1, then just skip to the last minute or so of the episode and you'll get a sneak peek for the next episode. Thank you so much for listening, and please enjoy my content.
Suppose that you work in New York, and you send a fax to LA. Interestingly, if you think about it, neither the ink being printed, nor the paper being printed upon, that comes out of the LA fax machine is actually from New York. And yet, some thing traveled from New York to LA. What exactly made this journey, and how does it relate to the origin of life? Let's talk about the matterless, energyless, intangible attribute called information. This is Acts of 20, Love, and Fate. Hello dear listeners. Good morning and good evening. You are listening to Acts of 20, Love, and Fate, a podcast of spirit and science. In this episode, we will talk about what information is, and the probability of information in proteins, in order to realize that functional information is the sole province of intelligent minds. Be mindful. Victory lies just ahead. Section 1. What exactly is information? As the title of this section states, what exactly is information? Some synonyms for the word information include, but are not limited to, details, particulars, statistics, data, direction, guidance, and intelligence. To illustrate the concept of information even further, the following idioms, or common phrases, centrally include the concept of information. As a matter of fact, news travels fast. Common knowledge. Knowledge is power. Breaking news, and great minds think alike. Take careful notice of the common theme of conveyance of some kind of knowledge originating from a mind to accomplish some specific effect. Believe it or not, molecular biology has a lot to do with information. Once we understand how information applies on the molecular level, you will witness the utter miracle of the existence of proteins. What kind of information must origin of life researchers explain the origin of? When considering the origin of biological information, the mystery only deepens. Listen carefully to this source, by University of Cambridge philosopher of science Stephen Meyer. But what exactly is information? It is difficult to understand exactly what information is. If you lived in New York and faxed a dictation document to another fax machine in Los Angeles, something will arrive in LA. But that thing, the paper coming out of the fax machine, did not originate in New York. Only the information on the paper came from New York. No single substance, not the air that carried the boss's words to be dictated, or the tiny sound recorder, or the paper that entered the fax in New York, or the ink on the paper coming out of the fax in Los Angeles, traveled all the way from sender to receiver. Yet something did. As evolutionary biologist George Williams notes, you can speak of galaxies and particles of dust in the same terms because they both have mass and charge, and length and width. But, you can't do that with information and matter. A blank magnetic tape, for example, weighs just as much as one loaded with new software, or with the entire sequence of the human genome. Though these tapes differ in information content and value, they do not do so because of differences in their material composition or mass. As Williams concludes, information doesn't have mass or charge or length in millimeters. Likewise, matter doesn't have bytes. This dearth of shared descriptors makes matter and information two separate domains. Whatever information is, whether thought or an elaborate arrangement of matter, one thing seems clear: What humans recognize as information certainly originates from thought, from conscious or intelligent activity. A message received via fax by one person first arose as an idea in the mind of another. The software stored and sold on a compact disc resulted from the design of a software engineer. The great works of literature began first as ideas in the minds of writers. Our experience of the world shows that what we recognize as information invariably reflects the prior activity of conscious and intelligent persons. What then should we make of information in living organisms, like ourselves? It is a fact that we do not only encounter and create information in our own technology, but we also find information in our biology. It is present in every cell of every living organism on Earth. But this begs the question, how did this information arise? What does information in my cells imply about humankind? Who, or what, wrote this book of life? How would you define information? It is much more difficult to answer this question than it is to ask it. A Merriam-Webster dictionary definition for information that can be applied to biology is, what is conveyed or represented by a particular arrangement or sequence of things that produce specific effects. According to this definition, information equals an arrangement or string of characters, specifically one that accomplishes a particular outcome or performs a communication function. Thus, we refer not only to a sequence of English letters in a sentence, such as, the car keys are in the living room, but also to a block of binary code in a software program, as information. If you are familiar with the macromolecule DNA, you may see where this is going. Dr. Meyer continues. Like the precisely arranged zeros and ones in a computer program, the chemical bases in DNA convey instructions by virtue of their specific arrangement, and in accord with an independent symbol convention known as the genetic code. Thus, biologist Richard Dawkins notes that, the machine code of the genes is uncannily computer-like. Similarly, Bill Gates observes that, DNA is like a computer program, but far, far more advanced than any software we've ever created. Biotechnologist Leroy Hood describes the information in DNA as digital code. After the early 1960s, further discoveries revealed that the digital information in DNA and RNA is only part of a complex information processing system, an advanced form of nanotechnology that both mirrors and exceeds our own, in its complexity, design logic, and information storage density. Where did the information in the cell come from? And how did the cell's complex information processing system arise? These questions lie at the heart of contemporary origin of life research. Clearly, the informational features of the cell at least appear designed. And, currently, no theory of undirected chemical evolution explains the origin of the information needed to build the first living cell. Why? There is simply too much information in the cell to be explained by chance alone. And attempts to explain the origin of information as the consequence of prebiotic natural selection acting on random changes inevitably presuppose precisely what needs explaining. Namely, reams of pre-existing genetic information. The information in DNA also defies explanation by reference to the laws of chemistry. Saying otherwise is like saying a newspaper headline might arise from the chemical attraction between ink and paper. Clearly, something more is at work. Yet, the scientists who infer intelligent design do not do so merely because natural processes, chance, laws, or their combination, have failed to explain the origin of the information and information processing systems in cells. Instead, we think intelligent design is detectable in living systems, because we know from experience that systems possessing large amounts of such information invariably arise from intelligent causes. The information on a computer screen can be traced back to a user or programmer. The information in a newspaper ultimately came from a writer, from a mind. As the pioneering information theorist Henry Quaisler observed, information habitually arises from conscious activity. This connection between information and prior intelligence enables us to detect, or infer, intelligent activity even from unobservable sources in the distant past. Archaeologists infer ancient scribes from hieroglyphic inscriptions. SETI's search for extraterrestrial intelligence presupposes that information embedded in electromagnetic signals from space would indicate an intelligent source. Radio astronomers have not found any such signal from distant star systems, but closer to home, molecular biologists have discovered information in the cell, suggesting, by the same logic that underwrites the SETI program and ordinary scientific reasoning about other informational artifacts, an intelligent source. DNA functions like a software program, and contains specified information just as software does. We know from experience that software comes from programmers. We know generally that specified information, whether inscribed in hieroglyphics, written in a book, or encoded in a radio signal, always arises from an intelligent source. So the discovery of such information in the DNA molecule provides strong grounds for inferring, or detecting, that intelligence played a role in the origin of DNA, even if we weren't there to observe the system coming into existence. Robert Kronk, software engineer and director of engineering operations at ArcServe, has stated, "I've been writing code for 41 years now. There are practically an infinite number of ways to organize the digits of code. For human DNA, the number of possible character combinations would be roughly 4 to the 3 billionth power, practically infinite, and a comparably small number of ways to organize those digits that actually create complex information-driven systems that accomplish tasks and goals. Randomly mutating code produces garbage, every time. See my self-mutating Python code project findings to get a good feel for what random mutation and natural selection ideas look like when applied to computer code. It's not pretty. It's hard to believe that people still accept random mutation and natural selection as creative processes, when both of these processes demonstrably destroy information. The only time they are helpful is with simple selections, like beak length or skin color, simple adaptation. They can turn already existing knobs, they just can't create the complex knobs to be turned. This complexity is mathematically impossible at the level of a single cell. It's mind-blowing when you consider that the body plan of a human, and all of its mutually cooperative parts, is also encoded in that DNA, and the cell that contains it. And it's even more mind-blowing when you consider the environment, where billions of separate living things all interact in harmony. That's three levels of complexity. And when I say mind-blowing, I'm not appealing to disbelief, I'm just doing the math. The mathematical complexity is astounding. It's obviously encoded by an intelligent being. Thinking otherwise is like an archaeologist finding pottery shards and cave wall drawings, and saying, well, there aren't any people here, so this couldn't have been created by people. So, we need to do experiments on how sand, wind, and water created these pottery shards and cave writings. Why do we so easily accept intelligent beings as the cause of such simple things like pottery and writings on cave walls, but are so reluctant to assert that an intelligent being created the DNA within us? DNA does indeed carry information that produces specific effects. Of course, neither DNA, nor the cellular machinery that utilizes it, is conscious, in the same way a paragraph in a book, or section of software, is not conscious. So, how did it get there? In the 1940s, mathematicians and computer scientists began to define, study, measure and quantify information. But they made distinctions between several types, or conceptions, of information. What kind of information do cells have, in particular, in their DNA and proteins? Though obviously not a conscious agent, these molecules contain the know-how for building other molecules in the cell, and are essential for life. In general, there are two distinct types of information, what is called Shannon information, and specified or complex information. From this point on, specified and complex information will be synonymous with each other unless otherwise clarified. What is Shannon information? It is named after Claude Shannon, who, in the 1940s, was a young MIT engineer and mathematician. His work applied true and false statements from logical expressions to switches found in electronic circuits. His work was called, possibly the most important, and also the most famous, master's thesis of the century, and eventually became the foundation for digital circuit and digital computer theory. He would do this first by linking the concepts of information and uncertainty together, and then linking these concepts to probability. Without getting into extensive detail, all you need to know for this podcast series is that Shannon information describes information in a mathematical sense, but it cannot distinguish information that carries meaning from information that does not. To illustrate this distinction, consider the two following sequences of characters. 4 score and 7 years ago. Ruoff C. Sayor, Nat Evson Sarai Oga. I'm sure that the second sequence in this example obviously carried no meaning at all to you. But the second sequence is simply a scrambled version of the first sequence, Abraham Lincoln's famous opening address, 4 score and 7 years ago. The number of characters and the probabilities of choosing one of the 26 letters of the English alphabet, to create both sentences, are the same, and thus contain the same amount of information, according to Shannon's theory. But one of these sequences communicates something, while the other does not. Why? It's because of the arrangement of these sequences that allows the first sequence to impart meaning, and the second sequence to be meaningless. A mind purposefully choosing a particular order, or patterns of letters to create words to create sentences, which evoke concepts in the human English-speaking mind, performs a function or purpose, whereas the other sequence of gibberish does not. For this reason, information scientists often say that Shannon's theory measures the information carrying capacity of a sequence, and only that, as opposed to functionally specified information content. To summarize, the two types of information are Shannon information and functional, also called specified, information. Both concepts describe information, but only the latter specifies function. We cannot talk about the concept of information without discussing the concept of probability. You will soon see how these two concepts are linked. Simply put, probability is the mathematical representation or description of how likely an event is to occur. For example, imagine rolling a six-sided die. Now imagine flipping a coin. The die comes up on the number six. The coin lands on tails. Before rolling the die, there were six possible outcomes. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6. We are uncertain which of the six possibilities the result will be. Rolling a 6 on the die eliminates the 5 other outcomes, i.e., the outcome is not a 5, 4, 3, 2, or 1. Knowing what the die roll is, and what it is not, totals as 6 bytes of information. Before flipping the coin, however, there were only 2 possible outcomes. Landing on tails eliminates the only one other possibility, landing on heads, totaling only 2 bytes of information. Notice, the cast of the die thus eliminated more uncertainty than the coin toss. Thus, the cast of the die conveys more information than the coin toss. By equating information with the reduction of uncertainty, Shannon's theory created a mathematical link between information and probability. Here's a quoted example to illustrate this. You live in Seattle, where it rains a lot, especially in November. If someone were to tell you that it will rain in November, that would not be a very informative statement. You are virtually certain that it will rain then. Saying so does not reduce uncertainty. On the other hand, you know very little about what the weather will be like in Seattle on May 18th. You're uncertain about it. If a time-traveling weather forecaster with a flawless track record were to tell you that on May 18th next year, Seattle will have an unseasonably cold day resulting in a light dusting of snow, that would be an informative statement. It would tell you something you couldn't have predicted, based upon what you know already. It would reduce your uncertainty about Seattle weather on that day. Let's summarize. According to Shannon's theory, the amount of information conveyed, and thus uncertainty being reduced, is inversely proportional, the opposite, to the probability of a particular event occurring. In other words, the more information that is conveyed, the lower its probability of occurring by random chance. Recall that the information found within our DNA necessarily contains more than mere Shannon information. DNA possesses the joint properties of high complexity and specification, both of which invariably result from intelligent causes. While complexity refers to sequences that are irregular or improbable, and thus cannot be described by a simple rule or algorithm, specification matches something from the physical or sequence realm, with an independent function. It turns out that the base sequences that compose DNA are highly irregular, non-repetitive and improbable, and therefore complex. DNA also contains coding regions of specific sequential arrangements of nucleotide bases that correspond to functional proteins, and is therefore highly specified as well. As such, it is important to note that the design argument from DNA does not depend on analogical reasoning, as it does not depend upon the degrees of similarity between DNA code and computer program code or human language. It instead relies on the fact that both computer code and DNA code possess the telltale characteristics of complexity and specification. That is, complex and specified information, in both DNA and human design systems or languages. As mentioned previously, complex and specified sequences are the sole province of intelligent agents, and thus creates a strong argument for a designer as the origin of biological information. Structures of proteins. DNA and proteins, justifiably called the life-giving molecules in all living cells, is absolutely full of information. But what kind of information? For this episode, we will focus on proteins, and thus a brief discussion is necessary. From this source. To form a protein, amino acids must link together to form a chain. Amino acids form functioning proteins only when they adopt very specific sequential arrangements, like properly sequenced letters in an English sentence. Thus, amino acids alone do not make proteins any more than letters alone make poetry. In both cases, the sequencing of the constituent parts determines the function of the whole. explaining the origin of the specific sequencing of proteins and DNA, lies at the heart of the current crisis in materialistic evolutionary thinking. The sequence of amino acids in a protein, also called its primary structure, determines how the protein folds into an extremely specific 3D shape, called its secondary structure. The secondary structure plays a large part in determining the activity of the protein, and is vital for cellular metabolism. Proteins must appear in exact sequences to cause specific chemical reactions, or build specific structures within cells. This concept is called specificity. It is because of specificity that proteins cannot substitute for one another. There are some exceptions, but those will be addressed in a later topic. They are as different in purpose as an axe, drill, hammer, or screwdriver. Imagine trying to build a house with just a hammer. An inconceivability, especially considering that other specialized tools already exist that have been specifically designed to build such structures. The probability of proteins. What is information, probability, and proteins have to do with the origin of biological life? Consider, we previously discussed that there are 20 different, biologically occurring amino acids, the building blocks of proteins. Amino acids have to congregate in a definite, specified sequence in order to make something that quote-unquote works, much in the same way letters are arranged in the correct order to form words. I want you to imagine primordial Earth, right before the creation of the first biological organism. In the prebiotic soup of the prehistoric Earth, all the molecular ingredients necessary to create the first life, like amino acids, were mixed together in a randomly tumbling, also called Brownian motion, ocean-sized vat. According to materialists, this is where the amino acids create bonds with each other randomly, over and over again, trillions of them creating an uncountable number of random, mostly non-functional sequences. Again, visualize English alphabetical letters in your mind, but this time being thrown together at random. According to your intuition, how often do you think randomly throwing letters together would form a word? How often would throwing letters randomly form a complete sentence? Or how about a long, complex, grammatically correct sentence? Intuition alone screams no. Random combinations of letters would not often create words, and sentences even less so. And so, this is also the case with proteins. Allegedly, amino acids come together at random to eventually create long, specific proteins from sequences by chance alone, or so it is said by materialists. In general, this is the neo-Darwinian position. Even if we assume the world's simplest protein, where the amino acid sequence was as short as biologically possible, with the most ideal of conditions for random chance to succeed, and in the most minimally complex cell we can reasonably imagine, the odds are still incredibly stacked against the chance hypothesis. The odds of random chance alone creating the minimal number of proteins this hypothetical protocell would need to survive, in the most idealistic setting possible, are 1 to a number that is so astronomically large, that it is countless times larger than one of the largest numbers ever named by human beings, a Google, which is a 1 followed by 100 zeros. More people should weep for materialists. The resulting odds are so large that it is beyond human comprehension. The exact calculations for this can be seen in the appendix. The sheer size of the number easily tolerates a great amount of hair splitting regarding its calculation, without altering the obvious conclusion. Even with the most ideal conditions, and even though these suppositions are generous to the degree of absurdity, the resulting odds would still be far beyond question. Time and the universe. Some of you might be thinking, but what about the concept of time? I've heard numerous materialists argue that, with enough time, anything is possible. Indeed, if there was infinite time, then even extremely improbable events not only become possible, but inevitable. And while this would conceptually be true, what does current science have to say regarding the age of the universe? Does science say that the universe has existed eternally, with no beginning nor end? Or rather that the universe had a definite beginning? In cosmology, studies based on the microwave background radiation by the Planck spacecraft and the Wilkinson microwave anisotropy probe have narrowed the uncertainty of the age of the universe to about 13.77 billion years old. They accomplished this by measuring the cosmic microwave background radiation, or CMBR, that has persisted in the universe since the Big Bang, much in the same way you can measure the leftover heat in a room from a stovetop that has been recently turned off. The leftover radioactive heat from the Big Bang can be measured, and the age of the universe thus estimated. This left no uncertainty in the conclusion that the universe most definitely had a beginning. What's the point of stating this fact? It became readily apparent that the probability of an event itself does not alone determine whether the event could be reasonably explained by chance. The probabilities by themselves were not conclusive enough. We have to take into account the number of opportunities that the event in question might have had to occur. In order to illustrate this, imagine a bicycle thief named Gaston. Gaston is currently trying to guess the correct combination to a lock. Let's say there are four numbers in the combination. This means there are 10,000 possible combinations. The odds of Gaston correctly guessing the combination that would unlock the bicycle is slim, to say the least. However, he will definitely try more than one combination. Let's say that he has exactly 2 minutes to find the correct combination before he gets caught, and attempting one combination takes about 4 seconds. Even though Gaston can make around 30 attempts in this time frame, the odds are still very much against him finding the right combination. About a 1 in 333 chance. But now, instead, let's say Gaston has 12 hours to find the correct combination. The odds of him finding the correct combination in this time frame are all but completely certain, provided he has the patience and energy to do so. In the same way, the age of the universe must be taken into account so we can calculate the number of opportunities chance would have to generate random amino acid sequences of modest length. Perhaps with enough time, a functional amino acid sequence would eventually be created through a war of attrition. In keeping with our bike thief analogy, what if Gaston had help from two or more bike thieves, so they could, somehow, try different combinations simultaneously? Additionally, what if the bike thieves had an entire first shift, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., to test random combinations? Would this increase in probabilistic resources be sufficient enough to give Gaston a quote-unquote good, i.e., better than a 50-50 chance, of finding the correct combination to the bike lock? To see the mathematical calculations to answer this question as it applies to the probabilistic resources of the universe, with the goal of creating a single protein of modest length, see the appendix for this episode. For now, we will attempt to reason the answer by using another analogy that better illustrates the various probabilities involved. I want you to visualize that you have a large, Santa Claus-sized bag in front of you. The bag contains one red marble and 10,000 blue marbles mixed together. If you sampled only one marble at a time by pulling out a marble from the bag at random, the odds are against you drawing out the red marble, or a 1 in 10,000 chance. If you took the time to sample 5,000 of the marbles, the odds are now in your favor, as you now have a greater than 50-50% chance of pulling out the red marble. But how long would it take you to get to this point, where you have a greater than 50-50% chance of finding the red marble? Assuming it takes 1 second to pull out one marble from the bag at a time, it would take 5,000 seconds, or about 1 hour and 23 minutes, to have a greater than 50-50% chance. After 3 hours have gone by, we would expect that you will have found the red marble. Now imagine trying to find the red marble by randomly drawing from the bag, but you only had 10 seconds to find it. Would you expect that you would have a reasonable chance of finding the red marble? At most, you could sample 10 marbles out of 10,000 possibilities, or a 1 in 1,000 chance. Odds are that you would not find the red marble in the time available. The issue with the chance hypothesis is that, when we consider the calculations in part 2 of this episode that are based on the actual properties of chemical and physical law, you wouldn't have the luxury of having 10 seconds to find the red marble. A more realistic amount of time that is consistent with the chance hypothesis to randomly generate one functional protein of modest length, is that instead of 10 seconds, you would have only 1 trillionth of a second to find the red marble. It is not within the purview of reality that you would ever successfully find the red marble. In other words, it is an impossibility. The universe itself does not possess the probabilistic resources necessary to render probable the origin of biological information by chance alone. We have established that the explanation for the origin of life demands more than simple chance. The English professor of astronomy at Cambridge University, Sir Fred Hoyle, has stated, "The chance that higher forms have emerged in this way is comparable with the chance that a tornado sweeping through a junkyard might assemble a Boeing 747 from the materials therein." Many origin of life researchers have expressed exasperation at the way some scientists use chance as a catch-all explanation, or a cover for ignorance. An article in Nature published in 1963, around the time where molecular biologists were first beginning to grasp the complexity of DNA and proteins, illustrated this well. The paper was written by P.T. Mora, a senior research biologist at the National Institutes of Health. Here is an excerpt. "To invoke statistical concepts, probability and complexity, to account for the origin and the continuance of life, is not felicitous or sufficient. As the complexity increases, and indeed very complex arrangements of molecules are necessary for the simplest living unit, the probability of its existence decreases. The probability that it will continue to function in a certain way will be even lower, and the probability that it will reproduce, still lower. Statistical considerations, probability, complexity, etc., follow to their logical implications, suggest that the origin and continuance of life is not controlled by such principles. An admission of this is the use of infinite time to obtain the derived result. Using such logic, however, we can prove anything. When the probability is so low that for practical purposes infinite time must elapse for the occurrence of an event, statistical explanation is not helpful. I have come to the same conclusion. Not only were the odds overwhelmingly against life arising by chance, even considering all available probabilistic resources, but the chance hypothesis was usually invoked in a way that didn't explain anything. To say that, given infinite time, life might have arisen by chance, was, in essence, a tautology, the saying of the same thing twice in different words. Given infinite time, anything might happen, or so the story goes. But that does not explain why life originated here, or what actually caused it to do so. Appendix. Biochemical considerations of proteins. Let's now move on to how we would calculate the probability of creating a protein, by utilizing the neo-Darwinian mechanism of random chance, upon which the theory centrally relies. This is where things get interesting. Let's do some simple math and talk about the probability of finding amino acids randomly in the prebiotic soup of primordial Earth, with the goal of creating a single protein. Since there's 20 biologically relevant amino acids, this means there's a 1 in 20 chance, or 1 over 20, that the first amino acid randomly found will land as the correct amino acid. That doesn't sound difficult to accomplish. But what about the second amino acid? Well, the odds of finding another specific amino acid for our protein sequence is also 1 in 20, or 1 over 20. When we combine these two probabilities that represent the first two amino acids of our sequence being the specific amino acids we want, the overall probability is 1 over 20, times 1 over 20, or 1 over 400. You can see that the odds jumped up sharply with the addition of a second amino acid, from 1 over 20 to 1 over 400. What about a third amino acid? The math would be 1 over 20, times 1 over 20, times 1 over 20, or 1 over 8,000. And so on. You're probably asking yourself, how many amino acids are there in a protein? How many amino acids long is a protein exactly? The answer is, it depends. In general, protein domains are between 50 to 250 amino acids in length. For a sense of scale, the largest known protein is approximately 34,000 amino acids long. For proteins of modest length, the average and most often used number in protein probabilities is 150 amino acids, and this will be the number referred to for average protein length throughout this series. So, how do we do the math to calculate the probability for randomly generating 150 amino acids, in the specific order that we want? It would be 1 over 20, times 1 over 20, times 1 over 20, and so on, until we have multiplied 1 over 20, 150 times. The mathematical shorthand for this number would be 1 over 20 to the 150th power. In 2004, a publication by a postdoctoral researcher at Cambridge University, named Douglas Axe, gave us a starting point to estimate the probability of randomly generated amino acid sequences that yield folded and functional proteins. Axe specialized in mutagenesis experiments, and in the study of the intricate folds proteins need, in order to perform their functions. He began to wonder how difficult it was to produce these folds by random mutations. The question was posed as, how rare, or common, are the amino acid sequences that produce the stable folds that make it possible for proteins to perform their biological function? The results of the 2004 publication are particularly telling. Axe performed mutagenesis experiments that enabled him to estimate the frequency of sequences that will produce stable folds. On the basis of his experimental results, he calculated the ratio of A, the number of 150 amino acid sequences capable of folding into stable, function-ready structures, to B, the whole set of possible amino acid sequences of that length. He determined that ratio to be 1 in 10 to the 74th power. This is an incredibly large number. For reference, another way of saying 1 million is 10 to the 6th power. Another way of saying 1 billion is 10 to the 9th power. To put this into perspective, there are 10 to the 65th power atoms in our galaxy. And since proteins can't perform functions unless they first fold into stable structures, Axe's measure of the frequency of stable folded sequences provided a measure of any functional proteins within that space of possibilities. This means that the ratio of A, the number of 150 amino acid sequences that produce any functional protein whatsoever, to B, the whole set of possible amino acid sequences of that length, is also 1 in 10 to the 74th power. In other words, a random process producing amino acid chains of this length would stumble onto a functional protein, only once in every 10 to the 74th power attempts. This finding has been confirmed by at least 4 other independent studies using different estimation methods. Axe's result is actually one of the more conservative estimates among these studies. But there are more probabilistic hurdles to overcome when attempting to assemble a protein molecule of modest length by chance in the prebiotic soup. Notice from this source first, from Dr. Meyer's book Signature in the Cell. All amino acids must form a chemical bond, known as a peptide bond, when joining with other amino acids in the protein chain. If the amino acids do not link up with one another via a peptide bond, the resulting molecule will not fold into a protein. In nature, many other types of chemical bonds are possible between amino acids. In fact, when amino acid mixtures are allowed to react in a test tube, they form peptide and non-peptide bonds with roughly equal probability. Thus, with each amino acid addition, the probability of it forming a peptide bond is roughly 1 over 2. If 4 amino acids were to form a peptide bond in a chain, the probability would be 1 over 2, times 1 over 2, times 1 over 2, times 1 over 2, or 1 over 16. Or 1 over 2 to the 4th power. The probability of building a chain of 150 amino acids, in which all linkages are peptide linkages, is 1 over 2 to the 149th power, or roughly 1 chance in 10 to the 45th power. In addition to this, in nature every amino acid found in proteins, with one exception, has a distinct mirror image of itself. There is one left-handed version or L form, and one right-handed version or D form. These mirror image forms are called optical isomers. Functioning proteins tolerate only left-handed amino acids, yet in abiotic amino acid production, the right-handed and left-handed isomers are produced with roughly equal frequency. Thus, the probability of attaining only L-form amino acids in a 150 amino acid peptide chain is 1 over 2 to the 150th power, or again roughly 1 chance in 10 to the 45th power. What do all these exponential values mean then, in the biological context of randomly assembled proteins? What do we do with all these numbers to calculate the probability that a 150 amino acid compound assembled by random interactions in a prebiotic soup would be a functional protein? I.e., all bonds are peptide bonds and all amino acids are L-form. We can find the answer by multiplying the separate probabilities, which is done by adding their exponents. Thus, 10 to the 45th power, plus 10 to the 45th power, plus 10 to the 74th power, gives a dramatic answer. The odds of getting even one functional protein of modest length, 150 amino acids, by chance from a prebiotic soup, is no better than 1 chance in 10 to the 164th power. If you thought the previous numbers were large, this number is larger by dozens of orders of magnitude. We don't have to do the math to know intuitively that the resulting number would be prohibitively large. Describing how large the number 10 to the 164th power is near impossible, but I'll try. You would have an easier time finding a single, marked particle out of all the particles in the universe, a 1 in 10 to the 80th power chance. Another way to say this, is that the probability of finding a functional protein by chance alone, is a trillion, 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 times smaller than the odds of finding a single specified particle, among all particles in the observable universe. The number 10 to the 164th power, completely, and dramatically, dwarfs these other numbers. To make the situation all the more difficult, there are yet even more factors that compound this issue that materialists must explain. The enormous number we just discussed represents the odds of only a single functional protein forming by chance. Any given cell has many more proteins than just one. The more clever of you may then be asking, how many proteins does a typical cell have? The typical RNA polymerase alone, the large molecular machine all cells use to copy genetic information during transcription, has over 3,000 functionally specified proteins. But let's give random chance the best chance possible, and for this example, we will use the simplest extant cell known, Mycoplasma genitalium, a tiny bacterium that lives in the human urinary tract, that requires only 482 proteins to perform its necessary functions. Based on knockout gene experiments, scientists have found that a simple one-celled organism might have been able to survive with as few as 250 to 400 genes. If we assume a minimally complex cell that requires only 250 different proteins to survive, then the probability all of these proteins assembling purely by chance is 1 in 10 to the 164th power, multiplied by itself 250 times, or 1 in 10 to the 41,000th power. More people should weep for materialists. This number is so large that it is beyond comprehension. It also allows a great amount of nitpicking about the accuracy of the estimates without changing the conclusion in the slightest. Even if we assume the most ideal conditions for a materialist argument, even though these suppositions are generous to an absurd degree, the resulting odds would still be hilariously massive and beyond question. Some materialists still insist on arguing this point, by saying that some amino acids have a higher binding affinity for other specific amino acids, which will lead to non-uniform binding, which is true to an extent, in the proverbial primordial soup. They usually cannot say what these new probabilities would be, for the 20 amino acids that would theoretically bind to each other in a random polypeptide chain. Even though the onus of explanation is on them, let's entertain this conjecture. Instead of saying there is a 1 in 20 chance for an amino acid to bind to another specific amino acid in the peptide sequence, let's say it's a 1 in 10 chance, to abundantly compensate for the contention. Dividing 10 to the 74th power in half gives us 5 times 10 to the 73rd power. We will round down and simply say it's 10 to the 73rd power. Some materialists may argue that the actual length of this hypothetical prebiotic protein is 30 amino acids, instead of 150. Again, let's entertain this unsupported conjecture. The new odds of creating a 30 amino acid long protein that will form peptide bonds only, and all amino acids are L-form only in that chain, are both 10 to the 44th power, rounding down. Adding the exponents of 10 to the 73rd power, 10 to the 44th power, and 10 to the 44th power, would give us the odds of a 30 amino acid long chain forming only peptide bonds, having only L-form amino acids, where the distribution of binding amino acids is non-uniform, 10 to the 161st power. Some materialists may additionally argue that this early cell would need only 30 proteins to function, instead of the scientifically documented 250 proteins. How this is biologically possible, they cannot explain. Yet again, let's entertain the idea. If we multiplied the previous number 10 to the 161st power, itself an overly generous and absurd calculation for the sake of the materialist argument, by 30, instead of 250, the odds become a 1 in 10 to the 4830th power chance. This is still a hilariously massive number. You can see that assuming even the most ideal and absurd circumstances for the chance hypothesis do not change the outcome, the odds would still be astronomically large. Chance plus time equals probability. Powerball is an American lottery game that is available in the majority of U.S. states. Guess 5 of 6 correct numbers, and you can win a cool $1 million. In the same way, Powerball has more, or less, winners depending on the amount of people that play, and how frequently the players draw, we must determine how many opportunities the universe has had to create a single functional protein of modest length, since the universe's beginning. How many players, or particles that can undergo chemical reactions, does the universe have? And how often, or how frequently, can these chemical reactions take place, or players, drawing, for the lottery? Let's start with time. In order to truly evaluate the probabilistic resources of the universe, we must consider the length of the universe in seconds. Rounding up, about 10 to the 18th power seconds have elapsed since the Big Bang. Why in seconds? You will see why shortly. We will need to consider another parameter that quantifies the maximum number of opportunities that any particular physical effect can occur. Due to the physical laws of the universe, physicists have determined that there is a limit to the number of physical transitions that can occur from one state to another within a given unit of time. According to physicists, a physical transition from one state to another cannot take place faster than light can travel across the smallest physical distance. This smallest unit of distance is the Planck length, or 10 to the negative 33rd power centimeters. Therefore, the time it takes light to traverse this distance determines the shortest time in which any physical effect can occur. This unit of time is the Planck time, of 10 to the negative 43rd power seconds. Let's review what we have discussed so far. Since there are a limited number of elementary particles in the universe, 10 to the 80th power, and since these elementary particles can interact with each other only so many times per second, at most 10 to the 43rd power times per second, and since there has been a limited amount of time since the Big Bang, 10 to the 18th power seconds, there are a limited number of opportunities for any given event to occur, in the entire history of the universe. If we multiply these three relevant factors together, the total number of events that could have taken place in the observable universe, since its origin, is 10 to the 141st power. You'll see that this calculation is similar compared to calculations from other scientists. During the 1930s, the French mathematician Emile Borel made a much less conservative estimate at 10 to the 50th power. More recently, University of Pittsburgh physicist Brett Van de Sande made a more restrictive 2.6 times 10 to the 92nd power. MIT computer scientist Seth Lloyd has calculated that the most bit operations the universe could have performed in its history, assuming the entire universe were given over to this single-minded task, is 10 to the 120th power. None of these probabilistic resource calculations are sufficient to render the chance hypothesis plausible. The calculation we made earlier is actually the most conservative, and gives chance its best chance to succeed. But you will see that even that calculation just confirms the implausibility of the chance hypothesis, whether chance is invoked to explain the information necessary to build a single protein, or the information necessary to build the suite of proteins needed to service a minimally complex cell. Recall that the probability of producing a single 150 amino acid functional protein by chance is about 1 in 10 to the 164th power. Meaning for every 10 to the 164th power generated sequences, only one will be functional. To have a good, better than 50 to 50, chance of generating a functional protein, more than half of the 10 to the 164th power sequences would have to be produced. Let's call that number 0.5 times 10 to the 164th power, and compare it to the maximum number of opportunities, 10 to the 141st power. Notice how the first number, 0.5 times 10 to the 164th power, is larger than the second, 10 to the 141st power, by more than 24 orders of magnitude, by more than a trillion trillion times. What does this mean? It means that if every particle, and every chemical event in the universe over its entire history, were devoted to producing combinations of amino acids of the correct length in a prebiotic soup, an extravagantly generous and even absurd assumption, the number of combinations thus produced would still represent an astoundingly tiny fraction, less than 1 out of a trillion trillion, of the total number of events needed to have even a 50% chance of generating any functional protein by chance alone. In other words, it would be vastly more probable than not that a functional protein of modest length would not have arisen by chance. The universe is simply too young, and altogether too few of the possible sequences would have been generated to provide a realistic opportunity for this to occur. And remember that we are still talking about a single protein of modest length. We haven't even gotten to the much longer, complex, and essential proteins that all cells require, much less the suite of proteins any cell would need to survive. And even if someone somehow got past this enormous issue that materialists need to explain, we are still considering only one cell, much less all the cells in an entire organism, and still less, all the cells in every carbon-based organism on the entire planet. Chance simply has no chance. We have reached the conclusion of this episode. To give you a sneak peek for the next episode, we will change the pace somewhat from molecular biology to the murder mystery theme of whodunit. Complete with inductive, deductive and abductive reasoning, historical sciences, and the best causal explanations of past events from present-day evidence and experience. You won't want to miss this. There is much more fascinating information coming. This is Paul Joshua, ever may your future be bright, and thank you for listening to this episode of Acts of 20, Love, and Fate.